The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Joined, as I am, by John Murphy, former Scotland Yard detective, and Sebastian Hamilton, who's the group editor of the Irish Daily Mail. We'll be talking about stuff that really relates to the Coulson affair. But first, I want to, if you don't mind, has anybody got anything to say about Suarez? Because we had it yesterday, and we have it again today, and there's been some... You know,
well, the difference between yesterday and today is Uruguay are gone home, unfortunately.
You can't blame Suarez for that.
They're after following him home.
But we now know about his defence. And his defence apparently is that he fell into the Italian defender with his mouth open and happens to bite him totally by accident. And given that it's happened to him a number of times in the past, you're kind of thinking it seems unlikely,
Luis.
My
uncle was in court for many, many years ago for an assault, and he was claiming self-defence. And his defence was that he thought your man was going to hit him, so he hit him back first.
So that's a good defense.
I have to tell you, I'm going between the two. Number one, I am going to. You don't go biting players. You don't go biting kids in playgrounds. You
no,
won't stop
of course
it.
Not.
The other side of it is, I also am well aware of his background. The guy has had problems. It's not easy for him to be who he is. You know, don't get me wrong, they all get well paid, but it's not easy to be Luis Suarez. And he's got a lot of personal problems, a lot of problems off the field that I think should have been addressed by the Uruguayan FA and indeed by Liverpool.
There was a psychologist on...
I think Liverpool are.
Yeah, there's a psychologist on the radio during the week, and he made a very interesting point that Luis Suarez is a very instinctive football player. So he does things faster than anybody else because he's doing them almost before he thinks about them. And this psychologist said that maybe it's the same thing when it came to the biting incident. Whereas I might think, I'm going to punch Brendan O'Carroll in the nose and then I'll punch you. Luis Suarez will have punched you before he's even formulated the thought.
You could see it in his face. And what have I done?
As soon as he did it, he knew it. And he was lying in the
sense. Why spend all the money on psychology? A simple gum shield by Liverpool or by Uruguay would solve the problem. Give him a gum shield.
None of the man thinks he doesn't need it. You know,
just stick it in his mouth.
A lot of the times, and I probably include myself in this, a lot of the times when people have problems, they're the last ones to realise they have it.
Can I just say one other thing about it? Because, you know, all the attention the last 3 or 4 days has been about Suarez. Yeah. But last night, Colombia were playing Uruguay, and an absolute wonder goal was scored by a guy called Rodriguez. I'd never heard of him. Yeah. He took the ball down on his chest and he volleyed it in. It hit the upright and bounced into the goal. And that's what the World Cup is about.
There was a photograph posted last night after the game of Rodriguez with Ronaldo 2 years ago, right, saying Rodriguez posted, "This is me with my hero," and you see him gazing up at Ronaldo and suddenly Rodriguez, and that's the wonder of sport, the brilliance of,
and we saw it
yesterday in the Chile Brazil game, tears, laughter, but I watched the games, but I had to spend the first 45 minutes trying to read the tattoos on the different things.
Everyone,
but I presume at the end of each game, when the players are hugging each other, they spend about 25 minutes reading each other's tattoos and swapping hairs.
The other big thing about this World Cup I've noticed is the coloured boots. Everyone is wearing yellow and blue. Now I remember once years and years ago I was playing football in Fairview Park, and I'm not a good footballer. In fact, I'm a terrible footballer. But the only football boots I could afford to buy were these red boots. And when you wear red boots playing five-a-side, you're making a statement. I'm brilliant. And unless you're brilliant, it's an absolute shambles.
But three brilliant columns, by the way, in relation to the item. In fairness, we're doing the Sunday papers. Yesterday's column by Donal Cusack in Irish Examiner, every Saturday, is a really fine piece of writing. The Examiner, where he spoke about the 7-year-old, the father absconded, the mother
and
had got a job as a cleaner.
Every reward he's ever had in his life, or every target he set in his life, came through the fact that he was able to perform on the soccer pitch, and that the fear of not being able to perform, or the fear of being outperformed, just terrified.
And the two ends of the complex argument today, Amory Hurin in the Mail on Sunday, and the headline says it all, I suppose. Biting is sexual and savage. Why what Suarez did is shocking. And then Kevin Myers writes another brilliant column, totally entertaining and erudite, as always, in the Sunday Times. And he goes at the other end. He says, all things considered, the Italian got off lightly. A mere nibble of a defensive shoulder blade, like a canap at a cocktail party, is scarcely any sort of meal for a peckish footballer these days. Not that I blame Luis Suarez for what for him was a relative fast. So there's two different ends of the
okay, well,
the argument
for there. Now we leave it as far as he's gone home. He's hopefully will. I feel a bit sorry for Liverpool, who are going to get punished now for the first part of the season.
But and is he going to end up in Barcelona?
It's very possible. Yes, and it didn't Borussia. Somebody offered 80 million for him as well. So
he was valued at 100. Now he's 80. He's shows you
down to 80. Well, that's probably because he won't have any teeth with him. He gets there. something I meant to ask the Minister, Mary, I'll ask you to comment on it because you'd have probably more experience in it before we get to the Colson affair. Apple in Cork, they're talking about 400 contracts that are, they have 23-month contracts with their staff so that they can circumvent the employment laws in Ireland. But none of that, when we do deals with people like that, isn't it? Is none of that approached? Do we not say, well, you have to operate within the employment laws?
I would have thought there was an understanding that you do have to work within the employment law, because they're not breaking the law.
They're circumventing it. They're giving you a 23-month instead of 24-month contract.
I didn't kind of see that
it's
story.
Something I meant to ask the Minister and I forgot about it, but I just thought I'd mention to you.
But they're all hugely important.
Jared, you're a lawyer, John. Yeah. Jared, you know a little bit about law, we know.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. First of all, you can have fixed-term contracts. You know?
Well, these are 20... The whole idea of this is to give 20... If you're 2 years in employment, you're entitled to redundancy. So if you let go after 2 years, no matter what it's contract or not, you're entitled to a redundancy payment. However, if you get a 23-month contract and get it renewed the day after on a new 23-month contract, it circumvents you having to fit in.
Well, I can tell you that would be certainly a challenge. If what they're saying is...
Well, it's not being.
No, but when I talk about if you had somebody who was employed for 23 months, then made redundant and then re-employed again by the same company...
But they wouldn't be made redundant, it'd just be the end of the
contract. I think, Gerard, we have that in the Mail and in every newspaper. It's about how long you're in continuous employment, regardless of the nature of your contract. So I think if you showed, I was there for 4 years... And there was just this one day where they changed my contract. I think the courts would probably recognise that you're in continuous employment, regardless of the fact that it's over two separate contracts.
Does that not mean that if you have it, would that make contracting defunct? I mean, if I have a contract for 23 months, at the end of 23 months,
you can't
effectively my contract.
It's in the nature of law that you can't. Again, as I'll defer to Gerald's greater wisdom on this, but my understanding is that it's in the nature of law that you can't basically have contracts that. As it were, undermine the law of the land. So although you can have contracts, they do still have to be subject to the law.
Yeah, that is true, but I see what Brendan is saying. Brendan, it'll be different, Brendan. I see your point is that at the end of 23 months, we're like, oh, good luck, see you.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very good
point.
No, but if you're then re-employed...
If you're re-employed...
That's counted as continuous.
Could be, yeah.
Out there who wonder what we're talking about, have a look at the Irish, the Sunday Times business section.
Certainly, we couldn't do that to our staff and expect to be allowed to get away
with it. But then you probably pay tax as well.
So, there would be some of that. Yeah.
Okay, let's get on to this.
One of the best gags in your movie, by the way, is the Google
I'll change my name to Google.
Yeah.
I don't pay tax, I change my name to Google.
Now, by the way, as far as the Sunday Times are concerned, they're having a go at you on the front page about your act of generosity yesterday, but as far as the Sunday Times are concerned, the culture section, your movie isn't even on in Ireland.
Oh, it didn't. It's not in there. Yeah, it's not in there. They missed it. Yeah. They missed it. And there was a tweet yesterday too, where I thought people were very cynical. Somebody said, clever move by Brendan O'Carroll giving away money on the radio to promote his movie. I really need to promote this movie. I'm sick of looking at myself.
By the way, apart from the glib response you always give, and maybe glib is the wrong word, I don't care about the critics. I mean, on the one hand, I was in Gorey for the weekend. I'm being stopped by people on the street talking about the movie. And they all said...
They all want to talk to Joe.
No, they all said they thoroughly enjoyed it. But from... I don't know whether you heard Arena here, the art show in RTE. Like, they gave it, which was... Anyway, don't go there. Out of 10, they gave it a half a mark. And they gave some obscure French film that's on in one cinema that, hey, you have to be a member to get in. 8 out of 10. But... like the weekend that's in it, on the one hand, at 147 screens,
the only audience that matters, I know all that cliched stuff, it's true.
But what I'm saying is,
it's
Brendan, Jenny,
how many
Rory,
movies have any of these critics
can I just say something
made?
I want to know from Brendan, Jenny, Rory, family, Fiona, Danny, Paddy, the whole lot of them, do any of the reviews hurt you?
Oh god, yeah.
No, seriously.
No, God, really, did
you? What would hurt you?
Well, things that Alan Carr wrote, said something in the style of Jenny sobbed her way through the last scene, which and the act, her acting was terrible. I thought Jenny, that last scene for Jenny was and promoting Murray Street was absolutely stunning. They also they missed the point. A lot of the things that they put out as being cynical were actually gags, but they do. I mean, they particularly hurt the younger ones. Not me. I at this stage now I'm like a sieve at this stage. But certainly the younger ones, they really do affect. And it doesn't matter that they look at Twitter and they see 10,000 people saying this movie is absolutely magic. The one that they see that says You're crap.
But Arena, for example, accused the film of being racist,
yeah,
sexist,
yeah,
homophobic, anti. They're pretty serious charges now.
What I loved about the Irish Times, and but I found it interesting in the Irish Times when the Irish Times said the same thing. They said, you know, it's racist where they have this Indian man who keeps saying he's not from Jamaica. He's actually from Pakistan, and by describing him as Indian just because of the way he looks is actually racist, and I was very offended by
the
Irish Times.
But even though one of the big tropes in the movie is the fact that Moore Street is now
multicultural.
That was
the whole
one of the
point.
Really positive things about
the movie. Said, no, they reckon that
an RTE programme, and indeed other reviewers as well, have accused you of being racist. Now, I know you bitch, there's not racist bone in your body as people, I think. Anyone even has a cursory knowledge of you. But does that type of stuff hurt you?
No, not really. I just honestly, Joe. First of all, I didn't even know it was on Arena, and the second thing is, no, you just get used to it. I can only write what I write, and I can only write what I think is funny. I can't write for them. I write for the audience, and the audience are coming out. It's the biggest opening movie of all time in the UK, and it's an Irish movie, which makes me very, very proud. And that's, I write what I write, and it is what it is. And if the critics don't like it, well,
often those critics are not in any way reflecting anything like the majority of what we all think. We all love it. I mean,
I would prefer.
Sometimes I think they're trying to make a name for themselves.
That wasn't my point. Point is, how do you, as a family, and there's very young members of your family involved in the movie as well. We can all take, whenever as good as the critics say we are, whenever as bad as the critics say.
I know, but there's some elements, and I include
Arena in this. There's some elements where the charges made against the film were pretty serious charges.
I know it hurts the younger members of the family. I know it does. They get out there, they work very hard. I'm very proud of how hard they work. And of course, it's like anybody who runs a family business, a shop down the country, or a garage down the country, or a farm, you expect your kids to work harder than anybody else works on it. And I probably have that expectation of them, but they come up trumps every time. But I do know it hurts them. But at the same time, I have no problem with a critic that says, that always critiques it in the first person. When they say, I didn't like this, I didn't like that, I don't think that's right, I don't. But they say, it's not right, then I get it. And as well as that, I also get offended. They, in some of the criticisms, they're calling the audience buffoons. And I don't like that. People are paying £9 in to see something and having a night out and having a laugh. They're not buffoons.
One of the reviewers on Arena, come back to this point, said that he sat through the movie, right?
Yeah.
For the hour and 40
93 minutes.
And he didn't laugh once. And he said no one in the cinema. Now, I refuse to believe that.
He should take out his iPhone.
Unless he was there in his own.
The worst than that, Joe, he said, I knew I wasn't going to like this movie. That was the preface to his critique.
Well, and that's a lot of the reviews were written before they went in.
And it reminds me of when we used to ban books we hadn't read.
Yes, that's right. But listen, enough about me. What do you think about me, Joe? No. enough about Mrs. Brown. Lads, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you.
Sebastian, I was surprised to see that you were hacked. Your phone was hacked. I mean, you're a group editor of the Irish Mail.
Well, it's a bizarre
journalist
story.
Journalist.
Well, listen, I felt pretty sickened by that myself. I mean, just to give the context,
please do.
I'd moved to Ireland in 2006, having worked at the Mail in the UK, and 5 years later, at this stage, you know, I'd married a wonderful woman from Howth. We'd just had our first baby. And I get a call from a detective constable in the Met in London who says, would you be able to come over to Scotland Yard? And I was kind of gulped and said, yeah, why? What have I done? Oh, no, you've been a victim of News of the World phone hacking. So I went over to London and I sat in a little room in Scotland Yard and I listened while they played tapes to me of voicemails that had been hacked from my phone by Glenn Mulcair. Because one of the things he used to do when he was hacking your phone, he would tape record it so that he could transcribe it later at his convenience. So I'm sitting there listening to voice messages on tape that were left for me back in 2006. Mm. A variety of things, mostly work-related. Then they showed me his phone log that shows him ringing into your voicemail time and time and time again. There was one entry. They said, oh, yeah, that's a third-party call. And I said, what does that mean? They said, oh, well, basically he rang into your voicemail and then he put it on a conference call so that other people could listen into your voicemail at the same time.
Gosh.
And then they showed me his notepad and the notes that he had taken, which included things like my PIN number, because I had a PIN number on my phone.
How did he get that?
Not quite.
There's ways of getting that.
You know, now I didn't know that. And I mean, yeah. I have to say, you know, I was gobsmacked that you could get, you know, because I was conscious of, you know, needing to have
some kind of protection,
but it never occurred to me that you could get that. So they ran me through all that evidence, and they wanted me to give a witness statement and potentially give evidence in court as a victim. And they were quite keen because in very few of the phone hacking cases did you have that much evidence all supporting itself. So they were very keen for me to give evidence. So I gave a witness statement and I was prepared to give evidence. I was actually on the witness list for the trial, but I think because the evidence was so overwhelming, they didn't actually need to call me.
They didn't need everybody.
It wasn't contested that I had had my phone hacked. So it was a pretty, I can tell you, it was a pretty horrible feeling. Firstly, the general feeling of violation of someone having
gone through your stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's like being burgled. It's that same sense of someone, how dare you go through my...
Oh, I want to actually ask you a very specific question about it, but I'm going to do so immediately after the break. But I want to ask you a very specific one. Here's a break.
Sure.
Welcome back, and Miriam, wherever you are, I hope you're getting a suntan. This is a horrendous job. I don't know why you do it. I have no idea why you would come in here on a Sunday morning and listen to this, but there you go. Sorry, Sebastian, I wanted to ask you a very specific question. They were hacking into your phone. Do you now know, or did you know then, was there something specific they were looking for?
Well, I mean, basically, they were trying to steal our stories. There was one... So, you know... My job then as news editor, I was kind of controlling or orchestrating probably a dozen reporters.
Right.
And I was in and out of meetings all day. So the reporters would give you regular updates on the phone. And if they couldn't get you, they would leave a message, here's what I'm doing. There was one specific story at the time. John Prescott had been caught having an affair with one of his secretaries.
Right.
And she was giving an exclusive interview to the Mail on Sunday. And they were... desperate to find out what she had
to say
so that they could try and get it into their paper. But I mean, the reality is, I think once these people had decided they were going to start hacking phones on an industrial scale, in a bizarre kind of perverted way, it makes sense that you'd also start hacking the opposition. And in fact, there's evidence that they hacked their own staff. They hacked their own political editor to find out what he was working on. There's some evidence to suggest that they hacked Andy Coulson while he was the editor of the paper so that they knew what their boss was thinking. I mean, I think they had just gone
mad.
They crossed the Rubicon, they'd gone mad, and it just became the default procedure for anything you were interested in. And there's a famous email from Andy Coulson to one of the reporters. Do his phone.
Yes,
and
I saw that.
I think that became the default setting. The minute you were interested in anyone, do his phone.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
You didn't get into journalism for this. You got into journalism because you had an interest in journalism. You got into journalism because you wanted to tell stories.
Yes.
Did at any stage going through all of this and seeing all this going on, have you gone, I'm done with this, I can't be in this business?
No, funny enough, never. And, you know, I think everybody understands that in any profession, you will get people who break the law. You will get your Breffni O'Briens. You know, there are, you know, Gerald knows there are solicitors who've stolen. You know, in every profession, you get people like that. So firstly, you know, I don't think it reflects more widely. Secondly, I think what we do and continue to do remains so important. I mean, you know, recently you know, it was the Mail on Sunday broke the Chew and Baby story, which has now led to a commission of inquiry. You know, that's an incredibly important thing.
Oh, listen, any journalist would tell you, if you get one of those in your lifetime, your career is a success, and that's great.
The Daily Mail campaign.
But did it change in any way what you wanted to report and what story you did tell?
No, because it was a group of people who had decided to behave as criminals, and that doesn't in any way affect what I do. You know, one of the things that surprised me, so there was the shock of having been hacked. You then have to realise also that it wasn't just that, that then the police were called in to investigate and they effectively whitewashed the whole thing. In 2006, the police only prosecuted one guy at the News of the World. They uncovered the evidence of me having been hacked in 2006. They didn't tell me for 5 years. They covered it up for 5 years until public pressure was brought. So if there's one lesson I learned from it, it's how astonishingly easy it appears to be for a national police force, effectively, to get so close to a big newspaper company.
Or anybody.
And, you know, politicians as well were terrified of going up against News International. And I think it made me realise how easy it is for, in any country, you know, where you have these big newspapers run by, you know, powerful business people.
For those to call the shots.
You know, for everybody to become compromised. And, you know, so if I take a lesson from it, it's how important it is for me as a journalist to try not to get compromised, even though often what we do and the attitudes we take doesn't necessarily, you know, it upsets politicians, it upsets, you know, powerful people, but I feel that we have to keep doing that. So it's never made me think that. If anything, it makes me think it's more important that I do my job.
I take it. Before I come to you, John, because I want to talk to John Murray, John Murphy, rather. John, before I come to you about Scotland Yard and your experiences there, Connor's away. I just want to say goodbye to Connor. Connor, thanks very much for coming with us. The key of your bike chain is out there. Just unlock your bike and I'll come upstairs. Gerald, you wanted to say something about this call to Ian, about the Crown prosecution?
Yeah, I was just going to ask Sebastian or John his views on there's an excellent article I read this morning with Tim Raymond in The Times, and he was suggesting, and you hit on it there, that since the police did so little in 2006, it seems to me that they may have overreacted by charging Rebecca Brooks. I mean, they seem to have 200 people, police officers. They spent over 30 million sterling. And then the Crown Prosecution Service said afterwards, oh, this was, you know, never about phone hacking or public profile figures receiving payment. But over 70% of the charges are about that. She was found not guilty. And there's a suggestion by Tim Raymond that it was overreaction on the police part. I'm just wondering what your views on that. She's found not guilty.
Well, Tim Raymond, let's not forget, is a News International journalist.
Yes, yeah.
So, you know, there is an issue there. I also think you mustn't forget, you know, five people were convicted on the basis of pleading guilty before the trial even began. So, in fact, there's six convictions overall for phone hacking. And I think the notion that they could have investigated this, uncovered everything they uncovered. If they had not prosecuted Rebecca Brooks, it would have simply added to the very strong sense that
somebody was getting off.
Powerful people were being protected. And, you know, it's you must know that it is not a failure of the justice system for someone to be acquitted. That's the justice system working. And here you had a very sophisticated verdict.
So where
you had a jury that were able to say this person is guilty
and this person is
and
not.
And on the evidence, that person isn't.
So are we, in a perverted way, are we, in a roundabout way, are we saying the best thing that could have happened to Rebecca Brooks was to be charged?
For her, I mean, you know, she can now walk out and say, look, you know, I've been tried by a jury of my peers who clearly listened to the evidence.
I get a chance to tell my story.
And, you know, and they've found me innocent.
John.
Rebecca Brooks, even in her contribution outside her house there 2 days later with Charlie Brooks, there was a little bit of contrition in her voice. She wasn't as triumphant as I thought she was going to be given the verdict. And you have to remember that News International, why did Murdoch shut down the News of the World? That's the first question. There was obviously something wrong. He poured countless millions into Rebecca Brooks' defence and the other people. Countless millions. The prosecuting barrister, the lead prosecuting barrister in the Brooks-Colson case was being paid one-tenth of what Rebecca Brooks and the other people's lawyer was being paid. Remember, News International deleted 300 million emails. 300 million emails from their hard drive.
But I thought you couldn't.
The police
emails.
Retrieved 90 million. 90 million. And a lot of them, we won't say much more about Rebecca Brooks, but a lot of the emails related, the hard drive relating to her time disappeared off the face of the earth. But why did News International delete 300 million emails? What was going on there? And the other aspect of the Sunday Times piece is at the bottom of the same page, Gerard, there's a piece basically pitting the whole story in the context of being the Guardian versus the Guardian versus Murdoch, and that's the other agenda. John, but anyway, John.
I want to come to John Murphy. John, you were a detective with the London Metropolitan Police.
Yeah.
You seem to have discovered all this kind of in retrospect.
Oh, well, I didn't. You know, I was there for nearly 20 years between the 70s and the 90s.
Okay.
And it was getting a bit like the Irish economy. You know, you had a feeling this wasn't going to end well, but nobody really wanted to hear it, you know? And just to go back to where I think it started, and which I won't go back too far, but just to sum it up, and when I joined in the 70s, it was an interesting time for the Met. They had been crippled by corruption in the 60s going into the 70s and had a clean-up operation.
But that was with criminals?
With police officers in certain departments. And a commissioner took over and they were being cleaned up. In this, there was a lot of waste. A lot of people were withdrawn. Some were convicted and went for prison. Some were resigned early. Some were forced to resign. And famously, lots of people went because they had a bad back.
Right, you know? Okay.
So this throws out into the public domain a group of guys with non-transferable skills, very specific non-transferable skills.
Security men.
Yeah, not a lot of use. What policemen could do back then wasn't a lot of use to anybody else at the time, you know? Yeah. So they had surveillance techniques. They had access to information. And then the next thing that happened was news. News went mental.
24 hours.
Yeah, Sky, Fox, it was all over the place. Mm-hmm. It was all over the place. And there was a demand for it like we had never seen before, you know?
A marriage.
A perfect marriage of two worlds. You know, these guys with all these skills that had been no use to anybody, meeting a market for journalism that had just taken off where anything was news.
An insatiable appetite.
Anything was news. You had to get stories out of stories. There was a model having lunch was suddenly news. And these guys, and their access, you know, we would get them, because a lot of them were thrown out unfairly or because we didn't agree with the way they were dispatched, they'd have very good access to us. You know, they turn
for
up...
For people who were still in the force.
The ex-detectives. They turn up at our leaving dues. They turn up at our lunches. They turn up at the station, you know.
I'd like to get a look at that for
you. Yeah, chat away to us. You know, could I have a look at that document? Could I have a look at that photograph, you know? Or have you got anything on him? And
so, John, can I just... And Sebastian's listening to this question too. Are you saying that, you know, whatever about phone hacking with this guy, that newspapers in general employed these detectives to source stories?
Yeah, they did. But more than that, it became an association. I mean, our world at the time included criminals, lawyers, journalists, some political people. And we'd see them in bars, we'd mix with them. Our paths would cross one way or another, professionally, sometimes socially. And it became a sort of information's a very valuable thing. And I was never against having an association with the police. The yard were always scared of it, you know. And then there's this thing I really think we were all sold a lie when we joined back then, you know. We were told that there was a war on crime and it was our responsibility to fight it, you know. And when you're told there's a war, breaking rules is okay. You know, we all break rules. We're told the system doesn't work. We're convinced the system doesn't work and we're convinced that we have to do something about it.
Outside the system.
Yeah, and it's easier to stop people who are corrupt for the sake of corruption than it is to stop guys who think what they're doing is right.
You're talking about no money changing hands here then?
Lunch. Jeez, you should see what they would give away. Politicians and
for lunch.
And for lunch. Policemen, lawyers, journalists for lunch. One of my mates had it, I mean, because our way of brokering information back then was quite developed before phone hacking ever came into it. I mean, phone hacking is like all corruption, it's slightly lazy, you know. We seek out the dissatisfied. We used to seek out dissatisfied people. So if somebody gets a senior post in a government...
Or somebody else?
Yeah.
You talk to somebody else.
Get the guys
else.
Who didn't get it. Get them that week and take them to lunch.
Mary,
give them a wine.
You want to say something on this?
Yeah, no, I think hacking, as Sebastian has said... It's really phone tapping, isn't it?
Phone hacking,
it's worse than that because it is an intrusion. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
And there was never any question or evidence that we were being hacked here. But I do remember a cabinet meeting a number of years ago where the Taoiseach actually said to all cabinet ministers, he said, to change your pins on your phone, that you may well be, I won't go stronger than that, that your phones may well be hacked by journalists.
Which,
right?
which would be the 5-year thing. People knew 5 years before you did.
The very fact that it was mentioned at a cabinet meeting meant that there must have been some evidence that somebody had brought.
But didn't we have a phone? Didn't
that,
we have a phone tapping? A phone tapping issue in the 80s?
Yeah. No, that was on landlines with Geraldine Kennedy.
But there is the very big issue. About intrusion into public people as well. I mean, I've talked about this before and I am going to say it, and Sebastian didn't seem to be aware of it. I mean, about the Daily Mail in particular, who followed me.
No, but it's really important.
Hang on. Who followed me.
I don't think this is really the forum for it.
And it's intrusion into public people and who actually wrote what I ate for my breakfast. Right. The only thing they got wrong was they wrote marmalade instead of just honey. So they're actually close enough.
Yeah,
to
but
see
can you prove
doing.
It was honey?
Right. Yeah, indeed, because it might just have been the marmalade, but that wasn't the point. Right. They followed me, took photographs of me, published them, and I didn't know they were there.
But now, I don't think there's any. I don't think there's anybody in the political or the entertainment field that this hasn't happened to.
No, but it isn't intrusion. When we went to the Gardaí about it, they said they could only do it if it happened in Ireland, whereas in fact it hadn't happened in Ireland. Right, it had happened abroad. Right?
I actually made a point of saying to the MD
at the time, do you make a habit of stalking widows?
You know, were you there as a widow or as a minister?
No, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you see,
I'm an individual. You were there as a minister, weren't you? Probably.
I'm going to say you were there on our money.
No.
Okay. And one of the things we do is newspapers.
No, sorry, but just let me finish.
Hold on.
Just let me finish. You do not
respond to the point that you've made.
I just finished the point.
I promise you.
You do not see. Of course, I'll let you back in. Of course, I'd be delighted to. You do not cease to be a person because you are a minister. You do not cease to be a woman because you are a minister.
Nobody's suggesting
that you do. As a media do not have a right to follow people. And to photograph them.
We don't have a right to photograph people without their knowledge. Okay, can I respond to that? Now, firstly, I am, as I said, blissfully unaware of this entire incident. I don't know when it happened or where.
A number of years ago, and I said it to your MD.
So, but anyway, one of the things we do as a newspaper is we try to make sure that you government ministers are being responsible with our money. You may recall, for example, called the Foss scandal, where a number of people in the Foss were spending huge amounts of taxpayers' money on stuff for themselves. There was a big scandal over Mary Harney calling a hairdresser into her room.
Are you saying that one of the ways you discover this is to follow everybody?
No, we don't. Absolutely not. And I mean, if you think we have the resources to follow people around, you know, we have an office of 150 people in Ballsbridge, of whom probably half are journalists. The notion that we can be doing
abroad.
My only point is about intrusion into people. If you are on a
If you are on
a publicly funded trip as a minister,
I'm entitled to eat my breakfast.
We are entitled.
I didn't even get the room service.
We are entitled.
You say.
To try within the law, and I stress within the law. To do our job, which is to keep an eye on you, because you're incapable of doing it yourselves.
No, I beg your pardon. The reason you don't do it in Ireland is because it wouldn't have been within the law in Ireland, whereas it was abroad.
Just one second. First of all, from I understand exactly where you come from, Mary. There has to be a limit where it comes to. But at the same time, if you run for office, or if you run for public office, or I get into the public eye, in the
and I do think it's a bit low. Saying on the one hand, you know, when I'm running for office, I'm a politician. But when the Mail does something I don't like, I'm a widow.
I would say it of anybody following me and writing what I ate for my breakfast, which I think crossed the line.
Well,
and of course, you are absolutely right as a media to keep people accountable.
If you want to write to me about this, I will address it.
Because I had raised it with your MD.
But that's the MD. I'm not the MD, I'm in my job. I'm not in this. I'm only in this job a year and a half.
Sebastian,
if you want to raise it?
Can I just ask you, what did you have for your breakfast this morning?
What did I have? I had toast with strawberry jam.
Be careful, don't say honey.
And my little boy had a putty filou, which I'm shocked to find apparently has 6 spoons of sugar in a putty filou.
Yeah,
which
but
may
I mean,
explain why he was so hyper afterwards.
But that's what you want. You want kids to be hyper. Well, listen, I got to go because it's that time. It's been a fantastic experience for me this last 2 days. I can't thank you enough. Yesterday's show was brilliant and today's panel were absolutely magnificent. Mary, you're some woman for one woman. And Sebastian, I take exactly what you're saying and nice to see that you've put the phone hacking behind you.
Oh, man, Archie is honoured, seriously, that you... But you took up the offer for the 2 days on your own time. You're a very, very busy man, yeah. So well, we appreciate it.
I've only done it once before, Joe, when I hosted a funny Friday for a friend of mine who was
And I'd like to finish the programme with a quote from Brendan O'Carroll in the Mail, which says, and I thought this was best, I'm not going to Hollywood just yet. Probably Hollyhead.
That's looking like it. So if anybody's listening, I'll see you in Hollyhead. Have a great week this week. Don't forget the movies. Also, wonderful movies on in the movies. Get yourself out to the pictures. There's some great movies out there. If you want to look in the Irish Times, they only gave my movie 1 star, but they gave a fantastic 5 stars to a wonderful Mexican movie, subtitled, that is also about a Guatemalan Indian. Go see it. I'm sure it'll be a barrel of laughs. Have a great weekend. Bye from me.